You are listening to New World Order, Episode 20, Season 13, for 1/32/2019. Hi everyone, it's pretty much all Udal Linux Ball episode this time around. That is because we have, what did I say last time, 8 applications, or eight commands, I guess we could say, to get through. I want to finish up the sbin commands in Udal Linux, the members of Udal Linux in the sbin folder. Last time we got up to set serial. This time we're going to start out with sfdisk. At first glance, sfdisk appeared to me to be the sfdisk version of GNU Parted. Really, that's kind of what it looked like. It is not. I believe, from what I'm gleaning from its man page, I think it's geared more towards really modifying partition tables, meaning that they must exist. The partition must exist in order to be modified. For instance, if I do an sfdisk dash dash list slash dev slash sdg, it reports correctly that the thumb drive located at dev sdg is 1.8 gigabytes, so 2 gigs, but there's no partition there. And that's correct, that is true. But trying to create a partition on that took me, well, I mean, really, I haven't gotten it yet. So there are a couple of different ways to do it. You can create a new disk partition interactively, which I'm not interested in. We could do it, but what's the point? There are other applications for that. There's GNU Parted, there's fdisk, there's cfdisk. Another option is to create a new partition table from a dump from another drive. So if, for instance, if I do sfdisk dash dash dump slash dev slash, for instance, sva, then I get this nice little readout of everything that SDA contains. So for instance, label GPT, label ID, blah, device, dev SDA, unit sectors, first LVA 34, last LVA, a big long number, and then dev SDA, start equals, and then a number, size equals, and then a number, and so on. So you can, if you dump that information into a file, then you can feed that file back into sfdisk using a redirect. So it would be something like sfdisk slash dev slash sdg being our target, and then a redirect back into that, so a left-facing bracket, or a less than angle bracket. And then the file that you're using as your template, really. So for instance, in this example, sda.dump. That would create the same layout on SDG as we see on SDA. Now, of course, in real life, as I do this example, that's not going to work because SDG is this 2 gigabyte thumb drive and SDA is quite large. But you get the sense of how sfdisk is expected to be used from this example, I think. It does certain processes in a non-interactive way. It has an interactive function, and on the whole, I'm just not super clear why I would use it personally than using, for instance, Parted for most of the things that I do, or Clonezilla for the big actual cloning of hard drive activities that I sometimes get up to once every year. I'm not saying that means that it's a useless application. Obviously, someone has a use for it because someone wrote it, and quite possibly for that person and for other people using that same workflow, this is absolutely priceless. For me, it's not exactly what I kind of had hoped it would be, and so that's kind of it for me and sfdisk. It was an interesting thing to look at. Okay, so next is swap label. Swap label is exactly what it sounds like. It is a way to change print or change the label of a swap area. So the command is swap label dash capital L or dash dash label, and that if you do that and then give it the path to a device, then you can change the label to whatever string you enter. So for instance, swap label, of course this has to be done as root, swap label dash dash label penguin slash dev slash sdg if sdg were a swap area, and then return, and that changes the label to penguin. You can also do that for the UUID. If you're not familiar with what a UUID is, a UUID stands for Universally Unique Identifier, and it is a string of numbers something like a MAC address, if you know what a MAC address for an Ethernet card is, for instance. If not, don't worry about it. But the idea is that every device, no matter where it comes from, what company output that device, what company is shipping that thing, it is the idea is that everything has a universally unique identifier. Now, I've never actually looked into it so diligently to know whether a universally unique identifier is like a literal statement, like there is literally no other thing out there with the same UUID, or if it's just kind of a functional thing where in a collection of hardware that is necessarily a subset of all hardware that exists, all items will have a unique identifier. I'm not sure how universal is, but the idea is that if you've got, let's say, 6 or 12 or 32 or 128 hard drives in your system, each one of those, when you pop it into the system, is going to come up with a UUID number by which it can be identified. And the vast improvement on what is it, BIOS, the UEFI system, is based largely around UUID. It assumes that the drives that it encounters in a system each have a unique identifier assigned to it. So you can change that unique identifier, and that's swap label dash dash UUID. Again, this is for swap partitions. Don't forget, now that I've wandered off talking about UUIDs, we're still talking about swap areas. So swap label dash dash UUID, and then specify a new UUID. It must be in the standard 8-4-4-4-12 character format, such as is output by UUID gen. And again, show it to a valid swap partition, so slash dev slash SDG3 or whatever, where SDG3 is a swap partition, and it will now have a new UUID. Of course, you would probably need to update your FS tab if you did that. Okay, next up is swap off, and immediately thereafter is swap on. I remember talking a little bit about swap off and swap on in some other context. I think I was probably clobbering some other thing. Yeah, it was make swap, wasn't it? That's what I was talking about. So swap off and swap on is, again, pretty much exactly what it sounds like. If you've got a swap area, and if you don't know what swap area is, go listen to the previous episode. I talk a little bit about what that is. A swap area, it doesn't necessarily need to be enabled. So you can disable swap manually with swap off, and you can enable with swap on. Basically, the command syntax is either swap on or swap off, and then some kind of identifier. So you could use dash dash, well, you can use dash dash all, you could use dash capital L for label, or you can use dash capital U to specify the UUID. Remember, like 10 seconds ago when we were talking about UUIDs and what they were? So it would be swap on, let's say, dash dash, well, no, dash capital L Penguin, and then it would search for a known swap area with a label of Penguin, and then enable that swap. You can also enable or disable a swap file, so it doesn't have to be a device. It doesn't have to be slash dev slash SDG1 or whatever your swap might be. You can do special swap files and enable and disable those by specifying the file path rather than a label or a unique identifier. There are some other things that you can do. For instance, dash dash options, you can then provide special comma separated FS tab compatible options. So maybe dash O discard equals pages, comma no fail or something like that, and then the path to the device slash dev slash SGG3, or you could have done that dash L for label or dash U for UUID. There's a summary, so display swap usage summary by device. That's kind of cool. Although you can also get that same information from cat/proc/swaps. So maybe that's not as useful anymore now that, there's that available. That's about it, really. I don't, this isn't one of those things that I anticipate certainly personally using manually, but I guess that it's probably there for either automated, you know, a tool chain that, is working without my knowledge, or maybe it's there as a manual override. Everyone loves a manual override. All right, next up is switch route. Now we just talked a little bit ago about, I think again in the previous episode, pivot route. And pivot route was kind of a weird, incomplete way of performing what looks and feels like a chroot. And switch route is kind of similar, except that rather than pivoting root, it moves currently mounted /proc/dev/sys/run to whatever you define as the new root, and it makes the new root the new root file system and starts all of the associated init processes. Switch root removes recursively all files and directories on the current root file system. So if you do a switch root, you're losing your old file system, your old root. You won't have access to the old root because you've now switched root. So you might wonder why you would use this instead of chroot. And again, you probably wouldn't. It's more something that you would be using, for instance, if you were writing an init system or writing some scripts to bootstrap a system where there was an init RD, that is an initial RAM disk, and after everything is set up that was contained in the initial RAM disk, you now need to mount the other partition, the real partition that you want to use as root, and switch to that as your root file system, kind of almost invisibly, kind of trick the system into just starting to use a different location as the root system, or the root partition. So if you're not super familiar with the boot process of Linux, I will explain at least this much to you. And for the record, there is a fantastic series on Hack Republic Radio, quite old now. It's from quite a long time ago. It's from Dan Washko of the Linux Link Tech Show. And he goes through the Linux boot process in, I want to say painful, but that sounds bad. Excruciating, that also sounds bad, in great detail. And it is a fascinating listen. So if you've not heard that, go seek that out and give it a listen, because it really does. And most of it, or some of it has changed, because, you know, maybe there's UEFI now, and maybe he's talking about BIOS initially, or maybe there's systemd now, and maybe he was talking about the different types, the BSD style and the systemv Unix style. It doesn't matter. The concepts remain the same, as they often do in Unix and Linux. So it's worth a listen. But what I will say is that if you haven't really played around with your boot process in Linux, then in order to, for instance, get your computer up and running such that you can sort of, well, so that the computer itself, the hardware, the motherboard, when you tell your BIOS or your UEFI to load this particular system, it needs to be able to, you know, as it boots, the Linux kernel starts to sort of be unpacked, and it starts to probe your system to find out what your system is made of. Now, if the Linux kernel that you are running does not have, for instance, a JFS module or JFS code compiled into it, then if it encounters a hard drive with a JFS file system, that is a hard drive that has been formatted in the JFS format, scheme, whatever, then it wouldn't it couldn't mount that hard drive and then read the data off of it. Does that make sense? I mean, in order for the kernel to be able to mount a hard drive and read data from it, it has to have the code that tells it how to read that hard drive. And there are, as any computer, almost any computer user knows, there are two kinds of hard drives, right? This is wrong information, but I'm just saying this sort of facetiously. There are two kinds of hard drives. There are those that are formatted for PC and those that are formatted for Mac. Well, actually, that's not true. There's one kind of hard drive, and you have lots of different file systems on those hard drives. So if your computer, or rather if your kernel, that thing kind of managing system awareness, doesn't know how to read a file system off of a hard drive, then it cannot use that hard drive. It'll just kind of, it'll stop and panic. It'll do a kernel panic and just kind of not know what to do. So in that case, because sometimes that happens, sometimes there's, for whatever reason, the kernel that you're running doesn't happen to have a very important module that you need in order for your computer to work. And the clever trick around that is you can do these things called an initial RAM disk. And that basically creates, when you're installing all of this stuff with this command called mkinitrd, which I don't want to go too far into because that'll be something that we find later on, I'm sure, in the package set. But it creates this little bundle that is to be unpacked and loaded into RAM as the computer boots. And this initial RAM disk is this kind of ephemeral, fake, pretend virtual hard drive that the kernel uses to set your system up. And one of the things in that init RAM disk could be, for instance, in this example, the module, the code module that is needed to mount and read a JFS hard drive. So now suddenly you've got this kernel that doesn't know what to do with the hard drive that it sees over on /dev/SDA. But for now, it's using this initial RAM disk as its root file system. And so it's putting things into proc, and it's putting things into /dev and /sys and all these other places. And then at the very last minute, once it has loaded the JFS module, you tell it, oh, and by the way, your new root location is here, /dev/SDA1, and it has a JFS file system, which doesn't scare you anymore, kernel, because now you know how to read that. And so let's mount it, and then let's switch root over to it, or pivot root, or whatever. So that's kind of the likelier use case of switch root and pivot root and things like that. So you probably aren't going to ever use that application, but I figured that was a good opportunity to kind of demystify the boot process for people who don't know. And it's otherwise, I feel like it's pretty similar to pivot root. Okay, that's good. And if you want more about pivot root and switch root, if you want to try that on a virtual machine, go to the previous episode, episode 19, and give that a listen, because I demonstrate how to do that in a virtual machine. Okay, I think it is time. I think we've all earned it. It's time for a coffee break. Start up the old virtual machine. This is a little bit scary, and that's why I am starting up the virtual machine for a command called wipefs. I imagine you could imagine why I might think that doing that example in the virtual machine is a good idea. So wipefs is, in a weird way, not as scary as it sounds, because if you run wipefs without any option, all it does is print, which I think is kind of nice. I think what I would have done if I had designed the tool myself, I would make that an almost I would make that a fallback behavior, which I guess it kind of is, but I would still encourage people to be mindful, I guess, of how they're using WipeFS, and rather than saying, just run WipeFS with no option for a non-destructive result. I might also really tell people, I would lie to people and say, WipeFS dash dash print prints the information, and then if someone forgets to put any option at all, then it, all it does is print. It falls back to print. And when I say lie to people, I would tell them to use dash dash print, and then I would put in parentheses at the very end, default. But anyway, I didn't design it, and no one's complaining that I know of, so who knows, maybe everyone's happy with it. Okay, so WipeFS here in my virtual machine, if I do an lsblk, I get VDA, VDA1, VDA2, VDA2 containing my CentOS root and CentOS swap. This is still that virtual machine from like 2 or 3 episodes ago for people keeping track. And then if I do WipeFS, that's all one string, WIPEFS, /dev/VDA, let's do 2, because I know that there's stuff on there. It looks like the offset is 0x218, and the type is LVM2 member. RAID UUID is a string. We talked about UUIDs before the coffee break, and that's what that returns. So then we'll do WipeFS /dev/VDA1. That tells me that there's an offset of 0x0, and the type is an XFS file system, and it gives me the contents and so on. So that's what WipeFS does if you don't tell it to do anything else. That's all right. That's not bad. Now, what you can do after you get that information is you can wipe the or erase. Now, stay with me on this one because this. It's a weird sentence. So it erases file system, RAID, or partition table signatures, which are the magic strings, from the specified device to make the signatures invisible for libblkid. And of course, we've used the blkid command before. So libblkid. Presumably, and I didn't look at the code, but presumably libblkid probably is the main driver of the blkid application. WipeFS does not erase the file system itself or any other data from the device. Now, on Slackware, the only other non-destructive thing I could do is do a backup, dash dash backup, and then that would create a backup signature file for the device that I specify, and I could then restore the signature file with a dd command. Dd in file would be my backup file, and then the out file would be dev/sdb, and then a seek number so that you're sure that you're not going too far. Byte size is 1, and so on. So I'm not going to do that on my Slackware system, although that does sound like a lot of fun. On the CentOS 7.6 system, the util Linux package is, I'm assuming it's got to be greater than the Slackware version that I'm running right now. So yeah, the Slackware version is 2.27. No, it's older on the CentOS system. 2.27 on Slackware, 2.23 on the CentOS 7.6 number. Isn't that interesting? So anyway, there's no backup command on the older version of WipeFS. So I can't do that particular non-destructive thing. What I could do is do WipeFS dash dash help, and then I would find that there is a no act, so a dash in or a dash dash no dash act, so that it does everything except the actual write call. And I could do that, I guess. Let's see if it breaks anything. If it does, I'll have to reinstall this whole system, the virtual system, and wouldn't that be annoying? But we're going to do WipeFS dash dash no act, no dash act, and then we're going to do a dash dash types XFS, because I happen to know that VDA1 contains an XFS. So here we go. And then it says, it just prints the information from VDA one. So it hopefully didn't actually do anything. I think it didn't, so it's fine. Yeah, it looks like it's got all this information there, so I think I'm okay. Now, why would you use this? Well, in theory, there could be the example that I could come across online, it's maybe if you've moved a drive from one system to another, then the system, your new system might not understand why that particular label, or that rather signature, is on that device. So you might have to wipe the signature and maybe put some other signature on it, or maybe you need to wipe the signature and then just grab the file, the contents of the file system, and put it somewhere else. Who knows? It would be something that you would either be told to do, or you would investigate and decide that that was the best tool for it. It's definitely, once again, not one of those tools that you're going to use very often in real life. These are all the really, really low level utilities at this point. I mean, it's Udo Linux. That's kind of, it's in the name. Okay, next up is ZipTool, and this is in Udo Linux, amazingly. I say amazingly because I find it funny that ZipTool would still be around. So here we go. ZipTool is a JAS and Zip tool set for iOmega drives, JAS and Zip drives. If you're new to computers, as of, I don't know, early 2000s or something, then JAS and Zip drives were, I believe, tape-based media. And they were, as far as I know, highly proprietary. And I believe, I vaguely have a memory that there were super strict restrictions on whether your Zip or your JAS drive would even be readable by a different system. Like if you were on PC, on Windows, then would it be even at all readable by Mac? And I believe it just was no, there was no way to do it. I could be wrong about that, but if memory serves, it was pretty clunky. But it was kind of the semi-affordable mass data solution for the home user, at least. I don't know if it actually ever made its way into the enterprise, because the enterprise had actual tape drives, tape media that would store massive amounts of data. So these, I think, were geared more towards the everyday computerist. And Zip, I think, did 100 megabytes initially, and then I think they came out with sort of an improved version of 250 megabyte size tape medias for the Zip. And then the JAS, I believe, was the big one, and that was, I think, 1 gigabyte of storage. And I know there's the whole more information can fit on my phone that's in my pocket right now than, yeah. Look, point is that there were these tape drives that could store a lot of information. They came in at a weird time in computing where everyone was wanting more storage but couldn't necessarily afford a whole new hard drive, or couldn't afford something fancy like a big tape drive. Which they did make that for home PC users. You could get a tape drive if you needed it, but and CDs hadn't, I think they hadn't, they either hadn't come out yet at all, like CDRs, or they were prohibitively expensive. And so Zip and then JAS drives came onto the scene and sort of carved out a little market for itself. And this is a remnant of that time. And it's probably one of those great things that it's probably a really good thing that this exists, because I can't imagine that there is, if I may use a double negative here, I can't imagine that there is nobody out there with a JAS or a Zip disk sitting around thinking, man, I would really love to get the data off of those things. And I also can't imagine that either Mac or Windows today could still process JAS and Zip. I just can't believe that they would have the kernel modules, or whatever they're called in those respective lands, for that. So certainly the drivers, that's what they're called. So ZipTool and JAS tool provide that. They do fancy things like eject you can eject the disk out of the drive. And it should be noted, as far as I know, the zip drives and the jazz drives themselves, the physical drives, were specific to the media. So, for instance, if you had a zip disk that's 100 megabytes or 250 megabytes, then you needed a zip drive. You could not put a zip disk in a jazz drive or a jazz tape or, you know, cartridge in a zip drive. So that's something to be aware of. And obviously you would need the special drives themselves in order for this to be useful at all. As you can imagine, I do not have that available to me, so I cannot test these. You could spin down the drive. You could make the disk read only. You could, let's see what else, you could add password protection to the media. You can lock the door so it can't be ejected. You can unlock the drive door, and so on. So that's zip tool, and I guess kind of like jazz tool. I don't really know if there's a separate one for jazz tool or if they're both lumped into that, but that is zip tool. And like I say, can't really test that out because I do not have anything approximating the hardware or the media. Next one, and the last one in S-Bin. So we've hit our mark. We've got our, I haven't finished it yet, but we're there. We're at the last one of S-Bin. ZRAM CTL, set up and control ZRAM devices. ZRAM is used to quickly set up ZRAM device parameters, to reset ZRAM devices, and to query the status of used ZRAM devices. If no option is given, all ZRAM devices are shown. So you remember how we've been talking about swap and swap on and swap off and all that other stuff? It's almost as if I planned it this way, and honest, I didn't, but ZRAM or ZRAM, I'm not really sure how you're supposed to say it. Either way, it used to be called comp cache, C-O-M-P-C-A-C-H, creates RAM-based block devices. So it's a little bit like a RAM disk, but as far as I can tell, it's very, very specific to swap. And it enables you to use a chunk of your RAM as swap space. Why would you do that? I really don't know. I honestly have no use case for this whatsoever, because I thought that the point of swap was that you have run out of RAM. So I'm really not clear on sort of the usefulness of ZRAM, and I'd be interested in hearing if anyone has insight into why that's something that is necessary. Maybe it's something that you can do in an initRD while the actual swap area isn't actually set up. I'm not sure. Anyway, the way that you do it would be first to make sure that ZRAM, the module, the kernel module, is loaded, and that's not necessarily a given. So that would be mod probe ZRAM. That loads the module if it isn't already loaded. Now you can do ZRAM CTL dash dash find dash dash size, and we'll do 1024 megabytes. And now it gives me a device called /dev/ZRAM1. Now, if this was the first ZRAM device that you had created, it would be /dev/ZRAM0, right? So that creates the ZRAM device. Now we need to earmark that as actual swap. So we'll do make swap /dev/ZRAM1. And it says it's setting up swap space version 1. The size is as expected, no label, and then it gives it a UUID. Now we'll do a ZRAM, we'll do a swap on, /dev/ ZRAM 1. I don't know why it's not auto-completing, that's kind of weird. Okay, there we go. Swap on. It is now on. If I do amount, how do I find out more information about these things? LSBLK, and there's ZRAM 1 gigabyte disk swap. So that is now being used in my virtual machine as swap in RAM. I can't imagine what good that does anybody. But anyway, that's how you use the command ZRAM CTL. And that is it. That's all the contents of util linux S-bin, or rather all the contents from S-bin slash S-bin contained in the util Linux package. Next in the list is user bin, which has a screen full of applications, and then we're done with util Linux. So that's exciting. But user bin has some pretty good stuff. I mean, it's got the old classics like cal and ddate and rev, couple of good ones. So I think it'll be worth looking at. But I feel like it's cheating to start down usr bin straight out of slash sbin, because I said that this episode was all about util Linux sbin, and that's what we've done. So we're gonna end it here, and I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
No feeling of movement at all. No vibration, hardly any sound.